or something else that I was like.
One second. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We'll be starting momentarily, but we're listening to something that Joe wanted to say first.
Okay. I'm gonna mute.
All right.
So I was getting went over and turned the heating to a cooler setting. She was in the other room. She came back in. And I said, if you get cold, put on a sweater.
That is the typical male response to women when they're cold.
But even in my own apartment, if it's just a little bit chilly, I would prefer to put on a sweatshirt than the temperature.
Yeah. Everybody approaches things differently. But generally speaking, because I rarely get out of the building, the only time I get out of the building is to go to a doctor's. I'm really, the halls may be a little bit cooler than my room, but it's not that big a deal. So let us start. L'shem Yehud Kud Shabarichu Ishkinte Bidkilu Urchimu Udhilu Udhilu Urchimu L'yakta L'shem Yud He Bavavhe B'yehuda Shalim B'shem Kol Yisrael Limud Torah Mitzvah L'asok Torah Mitzvah V'ahino Amadunai Elohinu Aleinu Maasei Yadenu P'nenei Aleinu Maasei Yadenu P'nenehu. So today we're going to be talking about what is commonly referred to as the Akedah. And as a little child, you are told this horrific story or this wonderful story, depending on how you view it and how the teacher presents it. The story is about this little boy. God tells Abraham, go sacrifice your son Isaac. He waited till he's 100 years old to have this son. And now he's being told, go sacrifice. And he loves God. He loves his son. What does he do? And we're told how important it is that he got up early in the morning and he went to do this, what God told him to do. And that's what we should all do, is listen to God and follow his commands. And then when Abraham has got this knife over Isaac, ready to slaughter him, to sacrifice him, God stays his hand, sends him an angel, stop. And then there's a ram caught in the thicket. And so Abraham can exchange Isaac, who's been bound on the altar, for the ram. And then everybody's happy, and they all go home.
Yeah.
I didn't hear.
Eventually Isaac.
And maybe a little bit soft.
Look, when you hear a few of the Midrashim about Isaac on the mount, you're going to find it very interesting. So we've all heard the story. We've all accepted that, correct? So I'm now going to read an English translation, and this is coming from the Kabbalistic Bible. So it has Kabbalistic explanations. And I always tell you, when you translate Hebrew, Hebrew has 70 explanations. It has 70 meanings in each word, in each letter, really. And all of a sudden, you have an English translation or a French translation or a Spanish translation, and they are just giving you one of the 70. So we have to keep in mind that this is a commentary, and a translation. The first thing to realize that on Shabbat's reading, this coming Shabbat, we'll read this. We won't read it because we don't do all the whole Torah, but if you're listening to the whole Torah, it's the seventh reading. It's the last reading of the parasha. And that's a significant indication that this is dealing with something that's connected to the physical world. Because the seventh of anything is the Shabbat. The seventh is the end of the week, the last of the week. And that means it's dealing with physicality. And certainly the idea of a sacrifice is dealing with physicality. So I am going to read this, and I will stop along the way to point out some of the things that are a little bit unusual. And it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham. And Abraham replied, Hineni, here I am. First off, almost, I can't say for sure it's nowhere else in the Torah, but you don't commonly hear God is testing a person. We will speak about testing. I passed the test. This is what happened to me, and I passed the test. But we will talk about it. We know that we are tested. But we don't see it in the Torah, except to my knowledge, in this place. I'm sure it's in other places in the Tanakh. But I don't remember any other place in the Torah where God is saying, I'm testing this person. And God said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as an olah, a burnt offering, upon one of the mountains that I will tell you. Mount Moriah is where the temple is. Mount Moriah is a very holy place. Now we're going to have a discussion. It's holy to the Jewish world because the temple was built there, or was the temple built there because the mountain is holy? It's holy to the Muslim faith. It's their fourth in a hierarchy. They identified the Temple Mount as the fourth holiest site on earth for them. And it's holy to the Christians. But in both cases, I ask the same question. Is it holy because of the building that's there, the mosque that's there, or whatever the Christians did on that mountain? Or was the mountain holy and therefore the human beings put some building or some structure to do that? It's a question that each person has to answer for themselves. Because what is something that's holy? When I first started to study Kabbalah, I had never asked that question. What is holiness? But holiness, after I got through discussing this with a Kabbalist in training, a student of Kabbalah, but a very prominent student. His name is Rabbi Abraham Sutton. He lives in Israel. He was born in Los Angeles, and I met him when he came back to Los Angeles to visit with his family. He was giving lectures in the area, and I met him, and so I had this relationship with him. And I've been following him ever since. And he is a very unique translator. You're all familiar with Rabbi Arya Kaplan. You've heard of his books. But Meditation in the Bible, Kabbalah in the Bible. He's written these books all through the years. Rabbi Sutton was his translator. Because he would write in Hebrew, and then Rabbi Sutton would translate it, and then they would work back and forth. But after Rabbi Kaplan died, at a young age, he was only 49, Rabbi Sutton was hired by his wife to publish all of his notes and writings. He was the one chosen to do all of the translations. He's a very unique translator. He's very careful in his translations. And we went back and forth about 2-3 months in emails. What is the meaning of holiness? And what he explained to me, we have the three columns of the tree of life. We have the right column that is sharing, the left column that is receiving, and the center column that is the balance between the two. And what he explained is the process of cleansing is to purify the left column. The sharing column doesn't need to be purified because you're sharing with somebody. You may have an agenda, you may have a reason why you're sharing that you expect something in return, but that's coming from the left column. Because it's coming from the idea of receiving. You're sharing, but you're really not sharing. You're giving with an expectation of receiving something in return. So the process of cleansing is to purify the left column. But then once you're purified, totally clean and pure, how do you become a right column person? How does the Levite, who is a left column person, become the priest, which is a right column person? This is what you have to understand holiness. And what he explained is you first purify the left column, and then something has to take you out of where you are and move you to the right column. And that's what it means when you say something is holy. Holiness is something that was pure and has been elevated to a higher level called holy. With that understanding, the answer to the question was the Temple Mount, was the temple built, and that's what made the mountain holy? Or was the mountain holy, and that's why the temple was built there? And the answer is, would we understand you have to be pure, and then something has to elevate you? The mountain cannot be made holy because you built a building on it. The mountain had to be holy because God said to the mountain, you're pure and I want you to become holy, and he elevates it. So getting back to the verse that I read, go to the land of Moriah. Well, the land of Moriah, Abraham is living in Beersheba. It's in the south. He's told, go to the land of Moriah. The land of Moriah is Mount Moriah. There's not a valley called Moriah. There's a mountain called Moriah. And then he says, and prepare your son as a burnt offering, where I will show you, where I will tell you to go. It doesn't make sense. Why didn't God say, go to Mount Moriah? Everybody knew where Mount Moriah was. we don't call it Mount Moriah today. We do, but we it's not a normal thing of conversation in Israel. It's the Temple Mount. We know that's Mount Moriah. So we have learned Adam built an altar. He built it on Mount Moriah. He built it where the Temple Mount is. All through the history of Noah building an altar, he built it on Mount Moriah, where the Temple Mount is, the same place. So Isaac is going to be sacrificed, the same place that Noah built an altar, the same place that Adam built an altar. But let's also understand, what is a burnt offering? Burnt offering is something that you put on fire. You kill it because you don't want to cause harm to an animal or a human being, but you burn it and the smoke rises up to Hashem. It's totally consumed. There's nothing left over. In the temple times, the ash was put on the ground and the ground swallowed it. So it was not even that was left over. But yes, there is ash that comes from the olah, from the burnt offering. But in essence, everything is consumed by the fire. And Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his servants with him and his son Isaac and cut the wood for the burnt offering and rose up and went to the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place in the distance. And Abraham said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there and worship, and then we will come back to you." You see anything wrong with that sentence, or unusual, or inconsistent? He's going to kill his son. Why would he say, "We will come back"? Why wouldn't he say, "I will come back to you"?
He didn't want to tell us.
That's a reasonable explanation. I just have to give you one more piece of information. When you talk about the binding, when you talk about the sacrifice of Isaac, what do you vision? What were you taught to see? There's a knife over a little boy bound on the altar. Am I right?
Right.
How old was Isaac?
A man.
He was 37 years old. Okay. He was 37 years old. He wasn't a little boy. So what is going on here? What is going on, and what is the test? It's not that he's willing to kill his son. We have a concept in Judaism called tikkun, correction. This concept is you made a mistake. Sometimes we call it a sin, sometimes we say it's a mistake. But essentially, you hurt another human being. You need to correct that mistake. How do you correct the mistake? It depends on what the mistake is. But essentially, what we are taught is the mistake is going against your normal nature. every person has a normal nature. I mentioned earlier, some people are right column people, some people are left column people. Some people are constantly afraid. Other people, they're never afraid of anything. They're constantly going to fight with somebody. They're looking to pick fights. There are people with all kinds of different characteristics, personalities. We call those midot, characteristics. A tikkun is to go against your nature. Everybody will hand somebody a glass of water if they're not doing anything. But if you're busy running to an appointment and somebody stops you to ask for a glass of water, will you go out of your way to get the water? Or you will say, I'm busy, I'll come back. The fountain is over there. Go get the water there. But you don't go do it yourself. Tikkun is going against your nature. Now, we understand that Abraham's nature is loving kindness, is chesed. We're taught that he had four doors in the tent in the desert so that people didn't have to walk an extra 10 steps to go around the tent to get to the door. He could come in any way, from any direction, he could walk into the tent. This was Abraham's nature. He thought about that. He would think, well, this man's going to be tired. I shouldn't have to walk extra steps. How many of us would even bother to notice that? But this was Abraham's nature. His nature was to do kindness. What is Isaac's nature? Isaac's nature is stern. It's discipline. It's power. It's judgment. Isaac, as he got older, his eyes became dim. Happens to all of us. We get cataracts, right? What is it really saying? Is dim eyes is a code word for judgment. He's constantly looking for judgment. He's not looking for the good in someone. He's looking for the reality of the person. So now you have a totally different relationship between a father and a son because they're two grown men. Yes, one is 137 years old and one is 37 years old. There is no way that a 137-year-old man can bind a 37-year-old man unless Isaac agrees to it. So when you say, he said we, it sounds reasonable, except Isaac's 37 years old. Isaac had to be told, we are going to a test. The Torah doesn't say that. The Midrashim does say that. But a Midrash is a story. I think that the Midrash comes from taking the Hebrew words and letters and putting a different word to each letter in the verse, an anagram. We've done that before in our classes, and we'll do it many more times. But the essence of these stories comes from the Torah. It's built into the Torah as a code. But a lot of people say, you know, that's made up. It isn't necessarily true. And I'm not, again, you don't believe a word I say, but test what I'm saying. The question is that plausible? The story is made up, and there are different stories that are seem to be in conflict. Does that mean that it's not true? That one is right and the other is wrong? Or can they both be right? Because they're in different worlds, different frames of reference, different dimensions. And we know from science today it can be different dimensions. So when Abraham said, "We will come back to you," what's going on? The other question is, he says he took his servants. Who are his servants? We know that Abraham had Eliezer as his main servant. Eliezer took care of his wealth, meaning the animals. He told all the employees where to raise them, all of the things. Eliezer was very important in Abraham's house. We learn in this parasha, or actually the last one in Lech Lecha, we learn that Eliezer, with a gematria of 318, was the one person that Abraham took with him when he went to get Lot back from Nimrod, the war of the five kings and the four kings. So we know that Eliezer was one of the two servants. But why did he take two servants? Who was the second servant? And the Midrash tells us that the second servant was Ishmael. And Ishmael is 50 years old. If Isaac's 37, Ishmael is 50. Ishmael's a grown man. He's married. He's got children of his own. Why is he going with his father? And why would he stop? To be replaced. Who knows? You're right. Those are options. So,
I was thinking that
before I said it.
Your son, he was about to
say, yeah. So,
Ishmael was his son.
Yeah.
Ishmael is his son. That's correct.
With another mother.
With a, absolutely. But Sarah told him to send Ishmael away, and he did.
Abraham.
Yes. And then you're going to find out that Abraham married Hagar when she changed her name and became Keturah. Because Keturah means the same as incense. It draws you closer to God. So it meant that Hagar had done Teshuvah. So she'd been sent away. She'd been saved by the angel and she'd raised her son. Sarah dies. And when does Sarah die? At the age of 127. She's 90 when she gives birth to Isaac. So she's 37 years later is when Sarah dies. When does she die? She dies immediately after the binding. But we'll come to understand that as well. But the question still remains. He's got these two men, these two servants. One's his son and one is his close friend servant. And he says, he first asks them, "Do you see anything up ahead?" And they say, "No, we don't see anything up ahead." So he says, "Well, you stay here, and Isaac and I will go on together." Why did you bring them to begin with? And he said, "See, the fire and wood are here." Oh, wait a second. And they went on together. And Isaac spoke to his father Abraham and said, "My father." And he replied, "Yes, my son." obviously they're establishing the relationship is why the words are like that. And Isaac said, see, the fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So they went on together, and they reached the place God had told him about. And Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood on it, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. I'm sorry. So, again, we have the same question. Isaac is 37. He's asking, where is the lamb? But he has to know. Why would Abraham bind him? He's got to question why he's being bound. It just doesn't make sense. But as to a child listening to the teacher tell this story, it makes perfect sense, because you don't have all of these questions that I'm asking. As an adult, you need to ask. As an adult, you have an inquisitive mind. You don't just accept the stories that you're told. You got to look into the details. So Isaac is agreed to be bound. Otherwise, Abraham could not have bound him. And he lays him on the altar. Abraham's nature is to be kind. He doesn't kill. He's being told to kill, not only just to kill, but to kill something he loves, his son, his only son. It's not his only son. Ishmael is his son also. But he's being told to kill his own son. It goes against Abraham's nature.
Is that sort of a nice way of saying, kill your son, your favorite son?
Yes, that is why. Why does he even have to say your only son or your favorite son? He says it because when God says, take your son and sacrifice him, Abraham's thoughts went to or could have gone to, I have two sons, so I'll take the one that's not as loved. But
Abraham was promised that he would have his nation. He'd be at the beginning of a big nation.
And he would be the father of many nations.
So
that's correct.
He had faith that somehow Isaac would be around to
become a nation. And that's very true, and very much that's part of what the language tells us. Otherwise, God told him where to go, but here the Torah is not saying to us, he's telling him, it's to the place I will show you, to the place I will tell you about. The language is very clear, but unless you read the Hebrew, it's not clear. It's very simple and simplified, but it isn't giving you the real understanding. Abraham's nature is to be loving. He's never going to kill his son. He can't even kill the kings that he defeated. He needs Eliezer to kill the kings because he can't do it. His nature is kindness and sharing and helping people. Isaac's nature is different. Isaac's nature is judgment. So why does Isaac accept being bound and put on the altar? Because it goes against his nature. His nature, if somebody came to attack him, would be to defend himself and to kill the other person. But he said, no, this is my father. He's telling me to do this, and I will allow him to do that. So you see, the binding is the two men creating a tikkun together. They're fixing something together, and what they're fixing is they're going against their nature. Abraham goes against his nature of kindness, and Isaac goes against his nature of harshness or judgment. That is what fixes the world. Prior to this, the world could be corrected by judgment. The human beings didn't do so. As we talked about earlier, the 10 generations could have fixed it all by themselves, but they didn't. Then the next 10 generations up to Noah, they could have fixed the world and corrected the world by the family groupings, and they didn't. So here comes Abraham and Isaac together. Isaac has to accept that love is stronger than judgment. And that's what the metaphor of Isaac being bound represents. That's what the story of the binding is about. It's about the two of them, by going against their nature, creating the tikkun, the correction. And Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." And he replied, "Hineni, here I am." But let's stay back at the altar. The Midrash says, Isaac saw the knife descending, got so frightened his soul left his body. He died. But then he heard, like a near-death experience that we hear about today, he heard the doctors on the operating table saying, you know, he's going to live and he would come back into the body. The Midrash essentially says that same thing in many different ways. Isaac actually died. And then he is resurrected. Now, what's going to happen at the end of time? What are we promised? The resurrection of the dead. So this correction sealed the world to work on love being superior to judgment. Doesn't mean judgment doesn't exist, because it does. We all know that. But what this action did was make chesed superior to givurah, to judgment. Prior to this, it could have gone either way. But Isaac accepted the binding upon himself. He dies, and he's resurrected. That is the story we have in all of the prophecies. The world is created. Man is going to do his tikkun, and then he's going to die and be resurrected.
Isaac was accepting of being sacrificed. Why did he need to be bound? Why couldn't he just lie down on the altar?
Thank you.
or is the binding itself?
Up until, if he was just said, oh, I'm going to accept it, can you be certain that a human being is not going to change his mind? Not in that circumstance, for sure. That's why he had to be bound. But it, why don't we call it the sacrifice of Isaac? It starts out, Abraham, go sacrifice your son. Go create a burnt offering of your son. Why don't we call it the Ola of Isaac? We don't. We call it the binding, the Akedah of Isaac. Because that's what it is. It was the testing of both of them that they would go against their nature. And once that was accomplished, we see the effect is the resurrection of Isaac. The Zohar tells us that Abraham represents the soul in our world today, the world of tikkun, the world of correction. Isaac represents the soul in the world that is coming, the world that after the Mashiach, where people will be resurrected from the dead. And the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham, and he replied, here I am. And he said, do not lay a hand on the boy, do not do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. I'm sorry, I got to ask this question. God told him to go sacrifice his son, right? Why is he listening to an angel?
Angels are messengers of God.
Yes, but how do you know it's just a true messenger? Aren't there angels that we call demons that work for the other side? How do you know it's the same? That it's a correct statement. Maybe it's the Satan trying to fool you. Why would Abraham accept the statement by the angel? He was told to sacrifice his son by God, directly by God, and now he's listening to an angel.
So, in the Akedah, God says to Abraham, sacrifice your son.
And the word is, let's go see which word it is. I'll go back to the beginning. In the first verse, and it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. So that's chapter 22, verse 1. The name of God is Elohim, the God of judgment, which is what you would expect. But now he's saying it's an angel of God. An angel of the Lord. So let's look at the verse 11.
He already was told to do it. The angel, they tell him.
And it's an angel from Hashem, not Elohim. It's the words are Malach Hashem. So Elohim told him to do something. Hashem is saying, don't do it, but it's not Hashem directly, it's the angel of Hashem. Doesn't make any sense that he would listen, does it?
This is like a second notice.
Maybe he didn't notice. Maybe he went, it could be the second notice. There are many explanations, and they're all correct. But it raises questions.
So he's got the knife like this, and he hears the voice.
And he hears the voice. Does he know that it's an angel? Or is he, when he hears the voice of God, he can't tell the difference between an angel of Hashem and Elohim? Maybe he can't tell the difference. You know, very few people have the experience of hearing the voice of God. There are a lot of people in our generation who tell you they've heard the voice of God, but we lock them up.
Or give them medication.
Or give them medication so that they'll go to sleep.
When you talk to God, it's prayer. When God talks to you, it's schizophrenia.
Exactly. Very well said. It's going to turn hard. Okay. So I know you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and there in a thicket behind him he saw a ram caught by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. Why did it have to be caught by its horns? Horns.
Cut the horn.
Why couldn't God just produce the ram standing in front of Abraham, and the ram doesn't run away? Why does it have to be caught in a thicket?
I presume it's a wild ram.
A ram is domesticated, but it's a male lamb. And the male lamb has a lot of connotations because it's a god of Egypt. The ram has to do with, while it's a male lamb, it's a domesticated animal. They follow the ram is the leader. So the females follow the male. So you could say it's not a wild animal, but the question I'm asking is, as a little child, you said, oh, the ram was caught by his horns. That could happen. But did it really have to happen that way? That's the question I'm asking. God can do anything. Why does he make the ram be in the thicket?
Makes it.
But it comes to teach us a spiritual law. And the spiritual law is there are natural laws in the spiritual world. And God follows those laws just as he follows the natural laws in the physical world. God does not do miracles that go outside of these natural laws. He does the most efficient use of energy. It's most efficient that the ram have his horns caught in the thicket. Because for him to stay, God has to make sure that the ram doesn't move. He has to create a condition that the ram goes against its nature. But if it's caught in the thicket, it's not going against its nature. It's got caught in the thicket. So why didn't Abraham see it before?
Let's ask that.
And that's because
it was asleep.
But why didn't Abraham see it before? Because it's the least amount of expended energy for Abraham to be blinded, not to be seen. How many times have you gone looking for a scissors on the table or a button on the table, and you can't find it? And then all of a sudden, it's there. The least amount of energy to expend to hide something is such you don't see it. Doesn't mean it wasn't there, it's just that you don't see it. This is how the Torah teaches us laws, spiritual laws.
Doesn't that say the Torah itself sizes the Torah? Yet the Midrash has other interpretations.
Yes. The Talmud. Talmud, the Zohar, the Midrashim.
Piles of books, shelves of books. Everybody has different.
Everybody's got a comment on
it. Everybody has a different interpretation of everything. It's fascinating.
It absolutely is. And they're all right.
Right. They're all right.
And that's,
they could do it wrong.
They could be wrong. But the real, what does it mean to be chesed, to be loving kindness? It means that you don't take the stand that I'm right and that makes you wrong. Chesed is that I'm right and you are also right. And that is the message that we all have to learn. And it's not an easy message for a human being to learn. You got to be knocked in the head over and over and over. It took Abraham 10 tests from being thrown into the fire by Nimrod to the binding being his 10th test.
Another test.
Oh.
To evolve in between, or does it have more to come?
No, the binding, the Akedah is his last test. But there's a whole list of the 10. I don't have it memorized.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I thought.
But the last one is the binding. Because the last one, he demonstrated that he went against his nature. The first test of being thrown into the fire by Nimrod and surviving, that was his faith in God. That was his certainty that God would help him. Or the fact that it doesn't matter. My belief is more important than my life. That was his test, being thrown into the fire. How many of us today would say our belief is more important than our life? But everybody who died in the Shoah, isn't that what we say? Their belief that they were Jewish was more important than their life. Many of them tried to escape. Many of them were shot escaping. But the bottom line was, it was the fire that Nimrod put Abraham through. The people in the Shoah were going through that exact same test. Only it was different. They didn't have to, you know, Nimrod, all he had to do was bow to an idol. What did the Jews have to avoid the concentration camps? They couldn't. There was no option. But they didn't have to go so willingly, did they? Abraham went willingly into the fire. The people went onto the trains to go because of, on the hope that it would be a better life than what they were experiencing in the ghettos. But let's see the effect. And Abraham called the place Adonai Yirah. As it is said to this day, on the mountain of the Lord it will be seen. And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, by myself I have sworn, said the Lord, that because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, that in blessing I will bless you and I will multiply your seed as numerous as the stars of the heaven and as the sand on the seashore. And your seed will possess the gates of its enemies. And through your seed will all nations on earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. And Abraham returned to his servants, and they rose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt in Beersheba. That's the end of the story. But there's four more verses in the Torah, in the Parashah. And it came to pass after these things that it was told to Abraham, saying, See, Milcah is also a mother. She has borne children to your brother Nahor. Buz, the firstborn, and Buz, his brother, and Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Chesed, and Chazo, and Pildash, and Chidtaf, and Betuel. And Betuel became the father of Rebekah. Milcah bore these eight sons to Abraham's brother Nahor. And his concubine, whose name was Rumah, also had Teba and Gaham and Tahash and Ma'ata. Abraham has one son, and he has Ishmael. So he's one or two sons, depending on how you want to count it. His brother, Nahor, has 12 sons. Where else do you find people with 12 sons? Jacob. But who does Isaac marry? Rebecca. The effect of Isaac accepting the binding is his soulmate is born. Now, when Eliezer goes to Betuel to find a wife, he finds Rebecca, Rivka. How old is she? She's 3 years old. Isaac is now 40, 3 years later. Because when the binding took place, Rebecca is born. 3 years later, she's 3 years old. Now, what three-year-old is going to say, yeah, Dad, I want to go over with this guy that we don't know. I'm going to run off with him and marry my soulmate. She's 3 years old. The Torah in Chai Sarah, in the next parasha.
I'm the cousins.
Yes, they're cousins.
And they're first cousins.
Yes, although it could be that we don't know
couple of years later.
Yeah, we don't know if Rebecca is coming from
and the brother.
We don't know which of his wives she's coming from. It's not clear right here.
Half cousin,
but. No, they're first cousins. There's no question the way we count it. But in those days, it wasn't counted that way. You know, who did Cain marry? Who did Abel marry? They married their twin sisters. In this generation, you were marrying your cousins. It's only later on when the Torah came that we were told not to marry cousins. It's an interesting story, and it's a different way of understanding it. And that's really, this is Jewish history. How are you going to understand Jewish history? It's in the Bible. It's a story in the Bible. You learned it as a child. It's a different understanding, absolutely. Are there any questions on the conference call? I'll let you unmute yourself.
No question. Thank you, Bill.
No questions?
No question. No.
You have a beautiful afternoon.
Okay, you too. Thank you.